I don't want your money punching my money.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. Oh.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... So, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
The f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP futures up 23, make that 24. NASDAQ futures up 130. The party is continuing. Well, guess what? We got NVIDIA up another 3.5%. It's up 456, so it's 140. So that'd be what? 1,400? Pre-split. That's a lot. Do we have the professor, Professor Mr. Liu?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy? What's going on in the world?
Chicago. Are you guys getting ready for this giant heat wave that's supposed to smack us?
We've been ready for about 4 days now. It's been really hot. Today's a little bit lighter, but then getting back up again this weekend. Maybe some relief next week, I believe, is the plan. I don't know how much relief is relief, but no, it's been hot and humid.
Yeah, I recall that the last really bad one, I think, was in the 90s, where you had like close to 1,000 people.
Well, that was
die.
That was singularly brutal. We were 9,800 for like we were over 100 like 5 or 6 days in a row, I think. This isn't anywhere near that. Like yesterday was 91 or two. Well, we were 97 on Monday, so yeah, that's pretty close.
Yeah, we're getting close to 100 out here, which is unusual for this early in the year. And we're also, fire warnings are up all over the place because we are just not getting very much rain. And it only takes, it takes a couple of days of, mid-90s to upper 90s temperature with a humidity around 15 or 20% that, suddenly you've got really dry brush and perfect conditions for fires. So,
well, they already
we're all kind of walking carefully here.
Well, California and New Mexico are already burning in some places.
Well, Ruidoso, New Mexico, which is one of my favorite places, and I don't know if you've been in that area, but it is the site of the world's greatest quarter horse race. It's where it's up in the mountains. It's near a mountain called Tierra Blanca, which has the southernmost ski area in the northern hemisphere, and it's this gorgeous mountain town. It's right next to the Mescalero Apache Reservation. They have a huge casino resort on the reservation called the Inn of the Mountain Gods, and Ruidoso is where all the West Texans and their oil money go to get away from the heat, and so of West Texas, and so it became a horse racing, this quarter horse racing place for some reason. But they have for a week or two in the summer, they have literally billionaires coming into town with their horses to race them and bet on them, and it's quite a place. Well, it's burning. I think they've lost almost 2,000 homes there.
Wow.
And I mean it's a nightmare because that whole area is, it's all pine forest and they've like a lot of mountain communities in Colorado, they've built up And so a wildfire gets going, and it just jumps from house to house to house. And I think they've actually had two people killed there now. So it's a terrible event, and it's terrible because it's a place I know well and have enjoyed, and I can't imagine what it's going to look like after this is all over.
Well, billionaire oil people, billionaire lawyers, same thing.
That's right.
Just saying.
No, I don't associate with the billionaires. I don't even associate. I mean, the horses are out of my league.
Well, the horse stuff is that's a different crowd, shall we say. I like the Audrey, my significant other, had a Audrey's always liked horses, but she had a friend who was in some kind of pony that used to go to all these different events.
Yep.
And every brand of horse, from ponies on up, are all shown. And you know who's really big into that was the Land O'Lakes people, the butter people.
Huh.
She was sitting next to them one night. I think she went to one. William Shatner was there. Doesn't he do what does he do? Appaloosas or something?
I don't follow Captain Kirk's.
Well, he does. He has some brand of horse that he's into. But sometimes they'll put all these crystal chandeliers up in like the riding arena in a barn, have a big party in there with a floor they bring in and crystal glasses and silver. It's like it's a different group.
Since we're free associating this morning right now, because I don't have a list of things I want to talk about.
I have
about
a few questions for you, but
we're watching the original series Star Trek.
Yeah.
My wife has not watched the whole thing through, so we're working our way through it with Shatner, and it's so bad, it's so cheesy, and yet it was all there was in the 60s.
Mm.
and it's really, I can really look at it and watch it and say, I understand why this only lasted three seasons. Well, I understand why it captured people's imaginations, but I also understand why it only lasted three seasons.
It's
painful to watch William Shatner acting.
He was the star of the show. But they ended up, when they decided, first of all, they were going to cancel it. And Desilu picked it up. Lucy was the one who basically saved the show. And she sold the reruns somehow. She doesn't make the money on the reruns.
It's syndication. I mean...
If you look at the pilot,
they pumped something like three or four times the normal budget into the pilot, and it shows. The pilot is, the scenery's better, the acting's better, the script is tighter. And then they went into production, you know, doing, you know, 25 shows a season, and they went to normal production values, and you can just tell, you know, hey, this is a first draft. This script is obviously a first draft, and they didn't have the money to pay the.
They cut the budget. The last couple of years, they cut the budget so much that it became cheesier and cheesier in terms of they had less people, they had less stuff done in any kind of a soundstage that was decent. You could tell.
Oh yeah,
but in terms of innovation, I mean, it was so far ahead of its time in terms of having African Americans on the bridge.
It had a number of innovative features, but they were, you know, at the bottom again. If that was their focus, then it's go woke, go broke.
No, it's not what they were doing. It was different
because
world
they thing. Lost. They lost focus on. I don't think that was their focus, but it's obvious. You know, the fight scenes, the crappy camera angles, the terrible sets, the total inability. I mean, they have several episodes with, you know, the sort of the Village of the Damned kind of theme with the kids that are psychos. You know, it's clear nobody knew how to direct children, how to act. Nobody knew how to write a script involving kids.
A lot of what you saw with that cheesy stuff was people also, you know, I'm kind of interested in this a little bit, Lou, but I'm certainly no genius on it. But a lot of what you saw, the improvements in television, had to do with people's perceived improvements in the TV people watched it on. So,
I'll admit, I'll admit, and one of the things, by the way, that this version that I'm watching, and it's very noticeable. They've digitalized all of the episodes so that they will play on a on a 4K a 4K television or flat screen, and it looks, I mean, the image clarity and everything else is much better.
You know what else they did? And again, this guy, just croaked. I mean, croaked maybe 8-10 years ago when you first watch him, because we used to watch him in college, the reruns, and all the dorms would empty out.
We did too. Yeah.
Well, but the thing, what happened, the original shows were like, kick me because I know I'm wrong here. I think the original shows were like 42 minutes. All hour-long shows back in the 60s were like...
No, that sounds exactly right.
Well, as time went by, they're like 38 minutes. Or 39, because they put more commercials in them.
Yep.
So, back in those days, when you watched it, especially if you'd seen it before, which of course I had, you could tell that a part was pulled out. But somebody invented some way where you could somehow speed up the vocals without, and somehow, and not make it sound like the person wasn't talking. He matched the faster vocals with the lip movement, which was an incredible innovation at the time. And this guy, he made a fortune by doing that, because you could now put all these old hour-long shows, 42-minute shows in the new 38, 39-minute time slot and not have them look crazy.
Yeah, not have them look stupid.
But I'm saying, when you look at one of the biggest innovators in TV ever was Hill Street Blues. Not because, you know, it was a Chicago thing or anything, but somebody decided, Stephen Bochco, decided that people's TVs, either now or soon they're going to go out and buy new ones, were able to handle a bigger screen and sound happening all around you. I mean, you notice in Star Trek, the only person talking is the one person.
Yeah, right.
And that's what looks cheesy about it, or one of the reasons why it looks cheesy. But now, you fast forward to the next generation, okay, which wasn't that many years later, all of a sudden there's sound all over the place, three people talking.
Oh, no,
it looks a lot different. But the first show that did that, if you try to watch Hill Street Blues on a 1950s 19-inch TV, good luck. You got the 2-inch speaker, and all of a sudden there's people behind you. There's four different people talking, and it never happened before. All before that, it was always one person talking, the next person talking, that type of thing. And it was because of what, I mean, Johnny Carson. They asked him, interviewed him once, and they said, "How come you got this terrific orchestra, and you don't ever use it?" And he said, "Because we think people got one inch speakers."
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, a lot of it has to do with that. Hey, I wanted to ask you.
Anyway, it's funny to watch, and like I said, you figure out once you get to the third season, it's pretty clear why the plug got pulled on.
Well, did you get to the one with Joan Collins yet? That's my favorite.
With Joan Collins?
Yeah.
Yes.
But that's a good one.
I've got one for you. I just watched one. What famous lawyer was on a Star Trek episode?
Lawyer. Not the guy where they were accusing Kirk of murder, was it?
No.
Well, I don't know.
Melvin Belli.
Really?
And I just watched this episode. He plays this monstrous thing called a Gorgon, but he's it's one of those children episodes, but Melvin Belli plays the evil alien. It is absolutely hilarious. He comes up on screen, and I'm watching the image, and I'm going, I know this. Who is this guy? I listen to this voice, and then the credits roll, and it's Melvin Belli. Unbelievable.
Well, you know, there's some things in there that are somewhat interesting. When they got to the point where, you know, when you before you fought the other ship, you could talk to the captain. You know, they've been,
yes.
And at one point, Kirk was saying, "Well, in the previous war, we didn't even know what anybody looked like. We just blasted them, and they blasted us. No survivors, no taken prisoners."
Yeah, that was the Romulan.
Yeah,
that was probably one of the best episodes.
Yeah, I mean, it was also the, you know what they snuck by everyone. The one where There was the good Kirk and the bad Kirk when it was the negative. It was the first time ever somebody had shown a navel on TV. Uhura was dressed in an outfit
and
showed her belly button.
And yet, all the women in the future are gorgeous.
Oh, without a doubt.
They're all gorgeous. Second of all, they're all dressed in uniforms that go all the way up to the panty line. I mean, just right. It's just hilarious. And my wife is commenting. She's going, look at these outfits. These are like the worst ever. And it's hilarious to look at. You know, they were trying to rope in eyeballs, and so they're sex sells, and they're doing whatever they could. It's just pretty funny to see all this rolling out and compare it with how the series, you know, Into Darkness or the Next Generation or whatever the series is where they got Christopher Pike.
Oh yeah, he was
the Star Trek.
He was the first one.
So they've got him in his own series, and to compare the two is just laughable.
Well, I mean, you advance in the budgets. What do you think the difference in budget was for?
Oh, it's huge.
The Next Generation versus one of those. It's got to be quadruple.
It's huge. I mean, they sat down and said, okay, we're going to do this right. They bring in Patrick Stewart, a Shakespearean actor. They bring in all these other, you know, other high quality folks to act in this thing. They put a special effects budget that just is riveting. Yeah,
Shatner was a pretty good actor. He was really good in the movie with Paul Newman when he was real young. He was terrific in that Twilight Zone episode.
Nightmare at 10,000 feet with the gremlin on the wing.
Now, was there really a gremlin or not?
One of the funniest lines I have ever heard in a movie, and I think it was called Showtime, but it's Robert De Niro and a black actor whose name escapes me, but they're real cops. And they've been brought in to play in a movie, to act scenes in a movie. And the director is William Shatner. And De Niro and the guy go through some scene, and you hear Shatner's voice going, cut! And the camera pans over to Shatner. Shatner goes, you are the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. And, I mean...
He's kind of a character.
Contrapoise between De Niro, one of the greatest actors of our time, and Shatner, who's just pure cheese. It was pretty funny.
All right, Louis, I gotta ask you, why from some of the stuff I read in the last week, it looks like the Houthi war is on. Why is it off the... All we read about now is NVIDIA going up every day. Why doesn't nobody care about this war in the Red Sea? They had some destroyer captain on saying this is the longest sustained period of time since World War II, since any U.S. ship is actually under attack, or any U.S. ships. What is going on?
Well,
how is that off the page?
That's wrong. I mean, in Vietnam, we had vessels vessels approaching Vietnamese shores and shelling shore batteries. I think it's crazy. I don't understand it. I mean, they've effectively shut down the Suez Canal. The dominoes that are going to start falling as a result of this, the revenue loss to Egypt is massive, which is going to foment civil unrest in Egypt. I do not understand why the international community, I mean, we're doing something, but why the international community is not blowing the living hell out of southern Yemen. This is piracy. These people are engaged in piracy. So, you know, pirates have a very special place in our international law. And so, let's go. You can do anything to pirates. And I don't understand why the international community, and why we are tolerating this kind of stupidity. And we're allowing it to happen. Now, I understand we don't want to get stretched thin, and I understand we're watching what's going on in the South China Sea, because that's very serious as well. But to allow a major shipping operation to be affected like this is nuts. And we have the wherewithal to stop it and make it so expensive that these people elect not to do it again. And I don't understand why we're not doing it.
I mean, what is what are we doing? Just putting people out there to be attacked and only, you know, yeah, defending?
Yeah, basically, yeah, we're providing you know, point defense as we can. I don't know if you saw the video of the attack on that Greek tanker that just or that
just,
Greek
just sunk, right?
Coal ship that just sunk. Yeah, you know, I don't understand what their self defense issues are. This is a daytime attack. You've got this radio controlled or radio controlled boat loaded with explosives running along the surface. The guys up on the deck have small arms. I don't understand why they didn't open up on the thing. It was you know, it's not going 90 miles an hour. They can shoot at it. I don't understand why they didn't open up on it and you know, at least try to knock it off course or damage its navigation system. And you know, the defense against those things is in some respects more limited than the defense against the airborne problems. The airborne stuff can be detected and it can be fired on within a bubble, and because it's above the surface of the ocean, it can be detected a ways out. These things run on the surface. They're small, and they're much harder to detect until they get in close. But you should have any kind of meaningful point defense, like a 50 caliber machine gun or even a standard NATO machine gun, should be able to deflect and damage something like this on a daytime attack. I don't understand why they didn't shoot at it. But the idea that now ships going in there are going to be facing this, you know, two or three, four boat attacks, suicide boat attacks coming out, is, again, to my mind, incredibly stupid. We know where these things have to be launched from. We know, you know, we know where their targeting information is coming from. There are Iranian vessels out there that we are almost certain are providing targeting information. I don't understand why we're allowing it to proceed.
I'm not, as you know,
there's no upside to this, Chief. Except
no,
maybe
we don't want to
make the Iranians mad. I don't know.
They're already mad.
I know. They're shooting rockets into they're shooting, you know, hundreds of rockets into northern Israel. They've announced an upgrade in their nuclear program. I mean, what happens if we make them mad? You know, how much worse is it going to get?
Well, as you know, I'm certainly not into the high tech stuff like you and, well, you and Carl certainly is. But I mean, you would think that we would be spitting out, you know, or taking some old ship somewhere and rehabbing the thing, some old aircraft carrier that nobody ever wanted. Why don't we have a drone ship where we have 50 of these things up in the air all the time over this southern area, and every time a ship leaves port, going after somebody, we know right where it is the whole way. I mean, this is. We seem like we get caught with our drawers down in this very low tech, high tech, new world. I mean, I know we have drones. I mean, I'm not hopefully not that naive, but somehow or another, our whole surveillance thing is not tied in with people that still have, you know, Toyota trucks and machine guns and this low tech stuff. And yet, I don't see why we don't.
Well, it would be, for example, not particularly difficult to go to some drone manufacturer and say, I want a bunch of these things for my ship. I want them programmed so that I can, one of my operators on the boat can fly them easily. And then I want a 155 millimeter artillery shell attached to the bottom of the thing. And they're going to take off, and when we see one of these suicide boats coming at us, they're going to dive on it. I mean, these things are not moving much faster than an armored vehicle in Ukraine, and you could put 30 or 40 of these things on a boat. You know, when you detect the vessel coming in, you launch the drone. It flies out there and it drops the shell on it, and that pretty, you know, these things have, for them to be effective, they pretty much have to come right up against the hull. If you can intercept them any distance from there, you just get a nice big.
But they're coming
explosion.
They're coming out of some harbor.
Of course.
Why don't we blast the harbor?
We know where that great point. We know where they're being launched from. I agree. I don't understand the calculation that says we can't promote this, or we have to tolerate this. Again, this is piracy. These guys have absolutely no protection under international law.
Who is, as you know, I mean, I'm always going to err on the side of zero war, but I mean, these guys can't get any more blatant.
As I said, they have no protection under international law. We could strike their facilities. The only thing I can think of as to why we're not doing it is we've got some force projection issue somewhere that we're worried about, or alternatively, we do not want to provoke our friends, the Iranians. And this administration is wedded to courting Iran. We know that.
Well, I think there might be something to what, you know, point A you just said, and we'll talk about it after the break, but maybe what we have over there now is all we can get over there. And if it all of a sudden gets hotter, we don't have the stuff.
Well, that's what I mean.
I know what you meant about force projection.
In terms of ability to project forces, we may be looking at ourselves saying, you know what, the Red Sea will take care of itself. People can just go around Cape Horn, the Cape of Good Hope, and they can do that. In the meantime, in the South China Sea, we have to move carriers in there.
Well, this whole idea of having the 10 monster carriers and none of the smaller ones, I don't get. I would love to see us with a carrier with Harrier jets on it sitting in the Red Sea taking out these things. We don't need the Abraham Lincoln to take these things out.
No, and again, that's you know, you wouldn't even need a carrier. You just need a drone ship, you know, a vessel with that capability. But, you know, because we've tolerated this stuff, we now face, you know, a multi-tiered kind of threat. If you move a destroyer in there, it's going to get fired at with ballistic missiles. So you need to have its capability, its high-tech capability in there to provide a bubble for the drone carrier to operate. And on each one of those drone carrier ships, you need to have layered air defense to protect against, you know, the slow-flying Shahed drones that are coming out of South Yemen.
It just seems like we might have spent gazillions of dollars on equipment that is not exactly set up for this.
Well, agreed, but it is set up. It's set up for our peer adversaries, and this goes back to the thing we talked about early on.
Well, let's do it after the break, because I mean, okay, all of a sudden our peer adversaries are losing the low tech guys, and now we're kind of caught with our drawers down. I think, unfortunately, a little bit. SP futures up 22, NASDAQ futures up 120. Be right back.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources.
Cut, 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 cut. Let's Let's do it again.
Freeze, LAPD!
Is that how he's gonna do it?
Hey, I'm laying my shit out. Look, freeze, LAPD! That shit is right perfect.
Okay, ready?
Patrolling your neighborhood at Friday
night at 8.
Patrolling your neighborhood every Friday at 8.
Yeah, good. And be happy.
Why should I be happy? I'm patrolling the neighborhood.
Well, you're happy because you're patrolling.
Keeping it safe, Mitch.
Patrolling your neighborhood every Friday at night.
Every Friday night at 8.
This is an easy one, Mitch.
This
patrolling
guy
neighborhood every Friday night at 8.
Is the worst actor I have ever seen.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
Everybody can have a bad day, even Robert De Niro. What can I say?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm laughing out loud here.
Welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. SP Futures up 21. NASDAQ Futures up 114. They were up 130, but still we're up. We got Dow Futures up 37. Individual stocks, like I said, Meta's up 471. NVIDIA's up 437. And NVIDIA up to like an 89 PE now. It's getting up there. Doesn't matter. Getting up there. Over in Europe, we've got the... DAX up 85.5%. These guys were down a bit last week, but they're making it back here. FTSE up 29.4. CAC around up 70.9. They went down pretty heavy with what was going on over there in the Parliament. Now that seems to have toned down a little bit. Bank of England has held rates steady. Switzerland makes its second interest rate cut. They're down to like 1.5 or 1.25. I'm not so sure how that works. But England is still at 5.25, which is right with us. So at least the U.S. of A and England are on the same page. And a lot of other people are not. Tuesday. It seems like a Monday, doesn't it? Dow was up 56. S&P was unchanged. NASDAQ up 5. So not much going on Tuesday. Over in Asia, we've got Nikkei up 62.1%. Hang Seng down 95.5%. 18,335. Shanghai dangerously close to going under this 3,000 level. 3,005 down 13 points. Bonds. Up 3 basis points, 4.25. The Bund up 1, 2.42. Japan up 2, 0.96. We've got oil is up 13 cents, 81.70. Now pretty far over this 80 number. By the way, I got gas yesterday. It was up 40 cents in a week. That's not the best. Brent up 27 cents, 85.34. Natural gas down 6 cents, 2.84. RBOB up a penny, 2.49. We've got gold up 6 bucks, 23.53. 2-week high. As soft U.S. economic data keeps rate cut bets intact. Get that data even softer, you get those rates down and everybody's happy. Not sure how that works. Silver up 77 cents, 30.33, back flying over 30. We'll see if it breaks out this time. Every time it's been over 30, it's gotten smacked right back down. Copper up 1 penny, 4.51. That doesn't mean you can sell it this time, though. It doesn't work that way. U.S. dollar 107, and that's the euro 126.8 against the pound, so kind of unchanged. And we've got Bitcoin up 1,300, had been going down, but not today. 66,242. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, everyone.
Cubs. You going to be a relief pitcher soon for those guys, or what?
I think that was his first win, actually. 640 here in Chicago, 72 degrees right now. High of 78 today. Possible thunderstorms after 3. Phoenix, 83 degrees now. Sunny and hot today. Extreme heat warning, that's 114 is the high there. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 17 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 36 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 28 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 19 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 29 minutes. MLB, Cubs beat the Giants. That was 5-6. Diamondbacks lose at Nationals, 1-3. And the Astros beat the White Sox on the south side. That was 4-1. So I got back to you, Chief.
Two things. The passing of the great Willie Mays. We'll have a special on that tomorrow with Kevin. Just a little bit of a tribute, a little bit of history. And Willie Mays has been a spectacular athlete and a tremendous ambassador of the game. So we're going to go through a little bit of that. Lou, did you ever see him play?
I don't think so. When was his last year?
71-ish.
I might have seen him play. If I did, it didn't register. I went to a number of Twins games in the late 60s when we moved to Minneapolis.
How would you have seen him? Because he's in the National League.
He was National League. I was just trying to think about if I didn't go to any All-Star games. I'm just trying to think if I saw any kind of... No, I don't think I saw him play live.
I saw
Mantle. I mean, I saw Mantle play. I saw Herman Killebrew play, obviously.
I actually saw Killebrew play and Bobby Allison. Those guys, they had some thunder, those dudes. Bobby Allison hit one at White Sox Park when I think I was a Cub Scout. And the dude hit one, went straight up. It was still going up when it hit, like, the second row of the upper deck. I think he was still rising. Like, God, he was a powerful dude, him and Killebrew. Man, Killebrew's shoulders wide enough.
Yeah, Killebrew was an armored personnel carrier out there. He was something. But no, Mays, what I always remembered about the videos of Mays was just the pure athleticism, the fluid movement, the way the guy moved around and ran, and the way he carried, you know, the way he carried himself out on the field. You just watch those videos and you just think, my, wow, this guy is really, really good. I'm trying to think. Well, it was DiMaggio, right, that called him probably the best player he'd ever seen.
Yeah, well, he was playing for one of the Negro League places in the summertime when he was still in high school. And they cut some kind of a deal. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Somehow or another, the baseball team, they did something. They delayed him a year. He was playing for them in the summer. They delayed him a year. They cut a deal with the high school. They delayed him a year in baseball or for paying him or doing something. So his senior year, he could still be the quarterback on the football team. He was on a football team and he was on a basketball team. I mean, go figure, if you're that good at everything.
Well, that's right, in high school.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he was best player on all three teams. But he was, you know, I was just mentioning it to my buddy Bill last night. I don't know how. I used to go from the south side. I'll get a load of this, Lou. We were 12, and we would get on a bus from way south and take it to Wrigley Field. Now, my mom had no problem with me getting on the L. But the L was in, you know, quote, the black neighborhood. But I never had any problems with that. She would have no problem with me getting on the L at 12 when I would be the only white person on the thing. Because in those days, nobody bothered anybody. I mean, if they did, you might have gotten a fight with another 12-year-old, but you sure weren't going to get shot. It just seemed like every time we went, with no pre-planning on our part, I always saw the Pirates. And I probably saw Clemente play five times. I never saw the Giants. And then when I got my 305 tickets, when I came down to the CBOE, it seemed like I always saw the Reds or the Phillies. I probably saw Carlton pitch five times. And I never saw any of these other guys. I mean, it just was weird how it just fell on what tickets they gave you with that package and who they had in those weekends. I knew everybody in the Phillies as much as I did the Cubs. There were other teams I never saw, but you didn't play the West Coast teams more than once a year.
Yeah,
and right. You played the other guys, you know, 17 times or something. So, I mean, I never saw Ichiro play, you know, on the West Coast. I've never seen this Mike Trout guy play in person. I mean, whenever he comes to Chicago, he's always hurt, it seems like. But, I mean, yeah, you could go a whole generation, I mean, seemingly like yours, and not see it's fantastic. But when he was in New York, I mean, he was the Polo Grounds, he had to have the biggest center field ever, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. The old Polo Grounds was huge.
For those that don't...
It was a Polo Ground.
Well, it was essentially a rectangular field.
Yep.
Where center field was a corner, and the side, well, there was two-something down each line, and center field was like five-something.
Yeah,
I mean, talk about room out in center field.
But yeah, he was probably one of those, you know, once in a five generation or so performers that just got steered into the right place at the right time.
Well, in New York at the same time. Now, there's reasons why these teams left and went west. Okay, well, one of the reasons was the jet aircraft, right? We didn't have to take trains, but I don't. Well, you know, I'm going to look this up for tomorrow a little bit. I don't think the Giants or the Brooklyn Dodgers ever did more than, what, a mil and a half a year. They were like the Cubs. The Cubs were, and the Sox, they were lucky to draw a million in the 50s and 60s, certainly in the 60s. The upper deck was closed during the week. I mean, people worked all day, and it was mostly day baseball, and you didn't get these kind of crowds. If you got a crowd of 20,000, they were ecstatic. But imagine having Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, and Duke Snider in the same city at the same time playing center field. I mean, Duke Snider was almost as good as the other two guys, right?
Yes, he was. Yeah, no, I'm with you. To be able to see something like that, you had that kind of concentration of sort of legendary talent. It's like the old, you know, the old NFL between you know, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore and Washington. You could see in that narrow corridor, you could see, you know, 50 Hall of Famers over the course of 5 years.
Yeah. Well, hell, I watched the the greatest game ever, right? Was it the 1958 or 59?
1958 NFL overtime championship.
Every player, it seemed, on either team, even though it was the Giants against the Colts, I knew the name. It was like they were all, you know. I mean, how many teams were there? It was eight teams in each conference.
Yeah.
You know, you had a, you know.
Do you want a funny story out of that game?
Yeah.
I one of the players that had played in there, and I've just dumped his name now that I'm thinking about it. I met him at the Viking training camp in 1968, and he was telling a story about that game where Weeb Eubank is the coach of the Baltimore Colts, and he was very excitable. And of course, Unitas was the quarterback. And so...
Not excitable.
Pardon me?
He was not excitable.
No. And so Unitas, they're driving down in overtime, and they're trying to figure out what play to call. You know, of course, it was a running game then, even with Unitas. So Unitas comes to the sidelines. They call a timeout. They've got the ball on, like, I don't know what, the 2.5 yard line, 3 yard line, and of course, sudden death. First team scores, wins, and they're not going to kick a field goal. The weather conditions were terrible. It was a crappy field. They want the touchdown. So Unitas comes to the sidelines, and Eubanks is so excited and fired up that all he can do is stutter. And he goes, jit, and Unitas looks at him and goes, got it, Weeb, and turns around and runs back out into the huddle. God. And then calls Alan Ameche over right tackle, and they touchdown and they win. But apparently every time after that, for those guys, and again, that team stayed together for a while. There's no free agency. Every time Unitas wanted that play called, he would get in the huddle and go, jit, all the guys in the huddle knew what he was talking about, and they didn't have to call the actual play.
Well, I was listening yesterday. Pat Hughes had one, and he's been around a while, a Hall of Fame broadcaster. And one thing I didn't realize. I mean, I never went to a game at Candlestick Park. I mean, what a letdown for Willie Mays to come from New York to Candlestick Park, that hellhole he used to play in out there. I mean, God, yeah, the place was awful.
It was kind of
freezing.
A dump.
Oh, plus it was freezing. Oh. But he said he would never, for some reason, the home team had their dugout on the first base side, which is, you know, it's not unheard of, but it's pretty rare. But whenever he walked to the batter's box, he would always walk behind the umpire and the catcher, not in front, as a sign of respect. Evidently, that's what you did in the old Negro Leagues. You never walked in front of the person. You always walked behind him.
Hmm.
And, you know, pretty interesting stuff when you think about it. And, I don't know what those guys made. And he also hit the ball where Joe DiMaggio called off Mickey Mantle, and Mickey Mantle tore his knee up in the drain thing. And Mickey Mantle's career, as good as it was, could have been a lot better. I saw a picture of that guy hitting a home run and limping around the bases. You said, how the hell is the guy playing?
Yeah, that was when I saw him play.
Yeah, it was, I mean,
the
he...
60s.
And he was a... I saw him walking through the airport, schlepping. He was a salesman after he left. I mean, he didn't last that long, but the guy was what, 5'10", maybe, shoulders about the size of a room. He was,
yep,
a strong man, but he was not very big. 5'10", maybe.
Yep.
He might not even been that. But
I mean, it's the change, again, noticing differences, the change in the athleticism and training of modern pro athletes when you compare them to what you saw even in the 80s. you know, like Joe Montana. You know, you could take Joe Montana and put him in a room of insurance salesmen, and he would look right at home.
Oh, without a doubt. But there, yeah. You know, again, it becomes a thing where now the guys are bigger, faster, stronger. Some of them are, not everybody, because there were fast guys back then and stuff. And you wonder what, like the NHL had what, six teams? So yes, would today's hockey player look bigger and healthier next to one of those guys? Hell yes, but on a skill set, how many rookies would come in a year? Like three or four? I mean, you got to be like really good as a skill player to break into those leagues. But I mean, some guys would always have stood out. I mean, John Beliveau would be a star today. I mean, Bobby Hull was a, you know, he was a secretariat in terms of build. I mean, he would stand out in a room today. I mean, Will Chamberlain would, you know, as a top of the gene pool. There were people at the top of the gene pool all the time, right?
Yeah, the guy that I always wonder how he would have done in the modern NFL is Chuck Bednarik, you know, who was the last of the two-way players in the NFL. He played middle linebacker and center, and he started on both sides of the ball. And the only time he came off the field, I think, was for kickoffs. And he, you know, and he was, as my father, who played with him, described him as probably one of the most frightening people he'd ever met in his life.
Yeah, well.
just in terms of sheer ferocity and focus and meanness on the field and the whole bit. And you know, you had an entire team in the Philadelphia that was frightened of the guy. And he... really, you know, I mean, just hard as nails and tough, you know, just a very, very physically tough, mentally tough kind of guy. And you know, you look at somebody like that and say, okay, you know, ferocity and belligerence go a long way in the NFL. And you wonder what a guy like that, again,
well, plus how big, how much bigger would he be? He'd be bigger if he was 225.
I think Chuck played about 250.
Yeah, and then now if he was, and those guys went to work at another job in the off season. If all they did was do this, he'd be 265. He'd be 270. He wouldn't look the same.
Oh yeah, yeah. He could play. I mean, I don't even know if they would have used him as a linebacker. They probably would have used him as a down pass rusher, right, or whatever. He certainly could have played at that weight. He certainly.
The guys that are were you know the whippet kind of guys, you know, your Mel Blount, those kinds of people, they play today. These guys today aren't any faster than
those guys. Yeah, I mean it's less of an issue for baseball.
Yeah,
in terms of size in the NFL, it size is, you know, give me the great big good guy versus the smaller good guy kind of thing.
Well, Jan's brother Pete, I don't know if you agree with this or not, because then I want to talk a bit about this. We don't have that much time, but just a little bit on the military budget side, for a few minutes. But you know, Pete used to say everybody thinks, when, you know, because Pete played during a huge steroid era, and because he would go to the Waffle House in the USFL and he would pee for like four guys, right? Because you could bring in your own urine. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. And but he said, you know, it's, everybody thinks it's the big fat lineman that is on the roids. He goes, it's not that necessarily. It could be a safety who's is totally ripped, and the guy weighs, you know, he's 6'2" and he's 210, and he's got, you know, a body that you could die for, right? He said that guy, if now that it's a 16 game season or whatever it is, just in terms of injury recovery, he wants to be 10 pounds or 15 pounds heavier, or 20 pounds heavier. He wants to play it at 215 or 220. He's the guy who's doing the roids between the Sunday game and the Thanksgiving game. Everybody thinks that those guys aren't. It's the big fat guys. That's not the truth. These dudes want to play 15, 20 pounds heavier with muscle that are normally, you know, I mean, Benny McCray and those guys, Willie Wood played at, what, 185? No, they're not. So because the roid stuff has a lot to do with injury recovery. It's not just being huge. Because those,
well, right. And
now they're going to go to 18 games, Lou. I mean, you're going to see offensive line. I don't think an offensive lineman who is supposed to start every game and play every play, I don't see how you do that in 18 games. I mean, you can see what's happening between the 14 and the 16.
Yes. Oh yeah. No.
Or 17.
The wear and tear on your body is unimaginable, and the idea that you're going to be able to keep people healthy. I mean, it's. I was talking to a trainer at the gym the other day, and she was noting that probably she has like, I don't know, like 75 or 80 clients, and she was saying, yeah, like more than half of my clients are football players, high school football players, and she says most of the stuff I'm doing is injury prevention, injury response, and that's in high school. Well, so it's I mean it's a violent, dangerous game. That's why we play it.
Well, yeah. Hey, we only have a couple of minutes, but the thing you and I were talking about earlier, try and tie this together a little bit. And I would like, just from my, again, you can tell me I'm nuts, but just from my reading of whatever what happened once war started, you know, and even the Falklands thing and what the ships went down, the Brits went down, the ships looked like when they came back, how they added machine guns to the decks and everything else. I think we've missed the boat a little bit, and the war is liable to fight right now. And not dramatically, but I think we need to bone up on, from what you've told me, on our ability to supply people at sea, those kinds of things which we seem to have let lapse. And I think we need to become, you know, first in the world in drones and maybe helicopter gunships that are on ships now instead of planes, or not instead of, but in addition to. Sounds to me like you want a helicopter gunship going after these things and not a plane, or is that just me?
I mean, the easiest, even the manned systems, you know, like a helicopter, are expensive to fly. What you want are other drones,
right,
to take the drones out, and you want.
I was talking about the ships.
For the ships, you want other drones on those ships that can launch drones to go after the drones that are coming in, and you want a very competent electronic warfare suite.
Okay, so what I'm looking at here, Lou, I'm trying to get to. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm looking at the defense, because we only got a minute here. We've talked about it all week. The defense is $899 billion, interest is $873 billion. I think, without, you know, even if we clean out some waste, I think this defense thing has got to go up 10-15%. Now, if it does,
I agree.
If it does, where the hell is it going to come from? We're already 40% in the hole every year. Now,
well, Joe Biden says we're going to tax all the billionaires.
Well, I think to a certain extent, the idea that the corporations are sailing along in this 21% range, I don't get. But I think those guys should go to 35% like everybody else. And oh, by the way, you should be able to deduct dividends so you don't pay twice. But I mean, this, the idea that we have these massive places. I mean, we actually, you know, despite the Trump tax cut, and I'm going to be fair on this, if you look at the entire tax revenue, corporate tax revenue is $477 billion, and we're up to like 9% of U.S. federal tax revenue. We were down to 7. So actually, we're up a little bit in there, you know, despite the fact that you know, some of the stuff that was in the Trump tax thing where they cut out some deductions actually has worked. So I'm not, you know, not pounded on that tax cut as much as, I mean, we got down to 7%, which was kind of ridiculous, don't you think, given the size of some of these companies. But now we're back up to like 9.5. You know, I could see that being 11, but we're not going to raise that. I mean, our deficit is what? Is, you know, almost $1 trillion a year. You could triple corporate tax rates and you're not getting there. I don't see that happening to you. I mean, why should you? The big hole, as Carl's always talking about, is in the Medicare. Medicaid is $1.8 trillion.
Yes.
Social Security is $1.4 trillion, but that's pretty much covered by the money people pay in for that purpose. Somehow or another, we've got to stop paying $1,000 for stuff that costs these drug companies $5. And that's where the slop is. But I don't think there's any question that the Defense Department needs to think about other types of wars than the kinds they've been thinking about for a while. They know that. You know that.
Well, if you look, they do. And if you look at the wish list that like people like the Navy and things like that are putting out, and it's been this way for 2 decades, Chief. We didn't get to this naval, this issues with our naval forces and our air forces by accident. For two decades, both those services have been saying, look, great, we're going to focus on our counterinsurgency and these unconventional wars that we're fighting in the Middle East, but we have to be able to deal with peer adversaries because those are the ones that are existential threats, and unless we need to do more funding. And they didn't. They didn't do it.
Well, 10 years ago, Lou, even you would have had a tough time walking into Congress with a straight face and saying we need more oilers and we need more ship-to-ship supply ships. And they'd look at you and go, we haven't fought a war. It was over 10 days and how long? I mean, you know, where are you coming with this, Mr. Lou?
Well, 10 years ago, see 10 years ago, the Russians invaded Ukraine. And we looked at that, we being the people in the defense community, looked at that and said, we have to be able to stop something like that. And we need conventional, heavy-duty, conventional stuff that can fight a peer adversary on the battlefield. And we need to be able to do it. And so you started to see stuff coming online. And in fact, we've got new stuff coming online that will deal with this peer-to-peer stuff. It's taking a while to get there, but we're getting there. And this is an extremely dangerous time for us, and I'm going to let you go.
Right.
This is an extremely dangerous time for us because we are getting good. We're getting stuff up. We're getting weapon systems in place that are going to equalize the disparity in numbers. And China and Russia know it. And so the window of opportunity for them is closing. And that's why this is an extremely dangerous time.
I was gonna say, that makes things pretty dangerous.
Exactly.
All right, but on that note... Have a nice weekend. By
Happy
the way,
Thursday.
stay away from any fires and stuff, will you?
SPV is
up 19, NASDAQ is up 106. Be right back, Mr. Dangenius.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Taking care of business. We must be talking to Professor Dan Janitis, just taking care of business. Dan, what's up? I know you're happy with your NVIDIA stock you bought last week, and it just goes up every day. And isn't it getting a tough start in the morning with a cigar? Doesn't that kind of make your mouth taste weird for the rest of the day?
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. Yeah, actually, the market cap has surpassed Microsoft at this point, the market cap of NVIDIA, so highest level ever. Interesting, Chief, there's a I'm in Boston right now, and so what I you know, business, family, but I also do a survey of a lot of younger people here who were, you know, clients and kids of friends and clients who are in the tech industry and the biotech industry. And it's really interesting that their perspective as, you know, 30-somethings is not as optimistic as the investors who are putting money into these companies, and they are working at these companies. So I have said this from the beginning. I think we're way overvalued. Momentum is driving it. There's no proven history yet. There's money that's going back into money. There's a mentality when I talk to people and you know, whether they be friends, current clients, family members, who say, we made money in this, so it goes up. We're going to continue to put more money into it. I remember years ago there was that mentality about real estate. If you were in a real estate market that hadn't seen a crash in a long time, well, you put all your money in real estate because it keeps going up. But at least there you had a tangible property. You had a physical asset. In this case, yeah, the balance sheets don't look bad for these companies, including NVIDIA. They don't look bad relative to where, the way they look with the dot-coms. However, there's no proven history. There's no proven history with AI. And the tiny bit that I've actually experienced, not impressed. It's going to take time for this to work out. People are buying a concept right now. They're not buying nuts and bolts. They're not buying assets. They're not buying what's currently going on. They're certainly not. They're buying this without knowing any history or operating history. All they're buying is they're just riding the momentum. And I'm very anti-momentum. My investment style is not momentum. It doesn't mean, you know, if you're thinking, well, hey, I'm missing out, I'd say the vast number of people are buying because of the fear of missing out.
Well, there's two groups, and one is equally, because I mean every time, Dan, I'll say something like maybe you should be careful of buying these stocks that have run up this much, and I talk a little bit about Microsoft, and there's differences and similarities to 1999. In 2000, 2001, the similarities are very momentum stuff. It's stocks going up. It's a new thing. It's the internet. It's click throughs. It's those kinds of things versus AI. I mean, nobody's made a dime on AI yet that I know of. Yet it's all over the place, and most people can't even really define it. I mean, I know I can't.
Exactly.
I sort of can, I think, because I listen to Carl all the time. Because I think he knows some of this stuff, and it's just faster and faster ways of doing the same thing computers have done forever. But then again, once you reach a new speed, you reach a new world, right? I mean, honestly, say I don't understand the energy drain on the stuff. But anyway, that's maybe Carl can talk about that tomorrow. But the difference I see today is, but it was the same thing. Dan, if I put a customer in the spiders back in 2000, I was putting 45% of their money in Oracle, Cisco, Dell, Intel, Microsoft, and whatever the hell the other one was. There's like five or six, which is the same thing now. But I mean, I'll sit there and say I have no idea how a stock, and I won't use one of them. I was going to say Microsoft. Any one of these stocks in the magnificent five or six or seven, but really it's expanding beyond that now. I mean, when I see, you know, Intuit jumping 15% and they're freaking tax firm. Now today, I'm looking at Accenture. Okay, it's up 10% or something after. Everything is now just being repriced 10, 15, 20% higher because they all are. And Cramer, you know, even he gets to be right once in a while, said that the NVIDIA, the fact that the thing is being priced to the sky is going to take all these other stocks right with it, because now it's the leader not only in valuation but in how you price stuff. I mean, I look at Microsoft and I go, you know what? How the hell is something that big, 14 times revenue, it can't double? Or if it does, it's because the federal government doubled the amount of money outstanding. It can't really double like you would think it was going to double. Or if it does, it's the only one that can. The rest of them can't. Google, Meta, Tesla, and NVIDIA, they can't all double, or else the economy's got to double, which I don't see it happening. Now, the question is, but now last week, you know, I put, I think we probably put $1 million to work last week. Guess what? 500,000 of it is on those stocks. And now, granted, I have puts there, or in case something bad happens, you know, the world's going to lose 40%, and my guys are going to lose 5 or 6. Because we're not, you know, we're still long. So yeah, will I have done my job? Yeah, I guess. But losing's losing. And why the hell am I buying a stock? Because what else am I going to do? I mean, everybody, all my clients, a lot of them have 401k plans. You know, not with here, obviously, because that's what their place they work. Every week, there's $200 going into a index fund, which, you know, it's probably the right. Now those people aren't calling up and saying, no, the next 5 weeks or the next 5 months, I want to go into a money market fund. Nobody's changing any of that. They're in for the long haul. What's the difference? I'm in for 20 years. There's a big difference. And I've seen decades when we're down on the decade. You know, I mean, I'm not predicting it here, but don't think it can't happen. Yet we just bump along here, and guess what? Have you ever seen, Dan, more days in a row of mutual fund buying on the close?
Right.
I mean, the checks are just piling up on people's desks. And if you and I ran a big mutual fund company, and all of a sudden, you know, 5,000 401k checks drop on our desk at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we look at Microsoft, and we're going to say, Dan, boy, this thing's kind of high. Man, Tom, it looks kind of high to me, too. What are we going to do? Well, I guess we got to buy. Here's our checks, right? It's driven not only by the people who are active. It's driven dramatically by the passive, which is different this
time.
I mean, I don't know how does that change? I mean,
It does change because if you look, we actually were at a conference last week. We're a virtual conference and talking to the CEOs and presidents of companies. And we always look at who owns the stock, you know, of these companies. And in this case, it was smaller cap and mid cap size companies. And a larger and larger percent are coming from the BlackRocks and the State Streets and the Vanguards. And they're all ETFs. They're all passive investments. So 60, 70, 80% are in of their shareholders, if you will, are in passive investments. They're not institutions who are buying for their pension fund clients. They're not retail investors buying directly. It's passive investment. For a lot of individuals who are doing what you just mentioned, putting aside a certain amount out of their 401k into some of these passive strategies, it does make sense because the dollar cost averaging into anything, you know, but more importantly, something like the S&P 500 makes sense. Now, you don't want to put 100% of your money there, but you're going to, you know, over a period of time, you're going to be buying some at a lower price and some at a higher price. So I would highly recommend that people continue to do that, not necessarily keeping all of it in an S&P 500, but certainly diversifying away from that into fixed income, into other strategies that I think are going to have more, that offer a lot more cushion and a lot less risk, especially as we get older. But the money that's going in is predominantly, in the shareholder base for a lot of these companies, is predominantly in passive investments.
Well, the I think what you and I are zeroing in on here is that's why, I mean, I won't say in our day, because hopefully our day is still today. In our day, you wanted stock to be in the $20 to $40 range. Now that obviously has gone higher. But now people are very comfortable with a stock that's $500 or $400 because individual people, well, it's easier to do an odd lot, as I explained to everybody on Tuesday. But the it's still, they used to be you didn't want just the institutional investors. You wanted individual people. You wanted, what they used to use the term, you wanted it to be widely held. Now nobody gives a crap if it's widely held. I'm looking here at the Nvidia. 966 million shares are owned by iShares.
Right.
Okay, which does the QQQ, right? Are they iShares?
Yeah.
I think so. I believe, I'm not positive.
Yeah, and that's
the QQQ is iShares, right?
It's the index. It's the NASDAQ index.
Yeah, Jen Hun something something owns 860. They're insiders. Is that the guy who owns it? Or and then the next one is the Spiders. Then it's the Spider Trust. And you go right down the list. Then it's Vanguard. And those are the people that own it, right?
And in a sense, from an investor's point of view, as I mentioned, it does make sense if you want to have exposure to a sector or to, say, tech stocks or to NASDAQ in general. It does make more sense to put it into an index rather than, unless you know the company and have done your research specifically on the company you're going to put your money with, I would suggest, you know, you want to have some exposure there. Keep a portion of your portfolio in the QQQs or the Spiders, the S&P 500 index. So I would agree with that, you know, especially for a retail investor trying to invest. I would, unless you either work there or know the company well or have done done all your research, don't just throw it into one of the stocks like Nvidia because it's going up more than the others. Diversify if you're going to be, if you want exposure. So from an investor's point of view, I agree with it. From the company's point of view, I think it presents risk because at some point, this not only will that one company go down, so as you mentioned that they're going up, like Intuit's following, for example, Intuit is following the Nvidia and all that because of the, they call it, it's like sympathy or contagion, if you will. So it has, you know, if one tech stock is going up, the rest of them will. But the same thing happens on the way down, and that's the risk. So that if there was one company in particular that had, say, contingent liability, there was a lawsuit, there was a unique situation that affected, let's say, Amazon, but didn't affect the other companies, those other companies are going to go down in sympathy because the person that owns that ETF or that passive investment is going to say, no, I'm getting out. Well, not only are they getting out of Amazon, they're going to get out of everything else, even though maybe those other companies are still doing well.
How's that going to happen?
Risk in the market, it's going to have a snowball effect if there is one. And that's my concern about being overly invested there, because then you have a situation where, you know, one of the companies gets hit and then everything's down. So not only have you lost the money and say, I'm using Amazon as an example, who knows, like, let's just assume something happened. Let's just predict that something could happen specifically to that company. Now all of a sudden you've got everything else trading down in sympathy with it. So you got to be very careful about the exposure. I don't believe in single stock exposure, again, unless you know the company and have done your homework. And I think as an investor, it's better to be diversified. But from the point of view of what we're talking about, everything is going to drop. If one of them drops, and that's because they're being held in passive investments, but because they're being held in these ETFs or funds.
Well, if you decide, you as the investment community, not you as Dan Janitas or me, if you decide that it's okay for the Qs or the S&P to all of a sudden have a, let me check this out before I say something, you might know off the top of your head, what's the PE now of the S&P? It's pretty much at a, it's got to be close to an all-time high.
It's an all-time high right now, yes.
So, okay. So what I'm saying is if you think it's okay for the NVIDIA to have a PE there, which is now like 80 or something, guess what? Your Accenture, which is an accounting firm, or somebody else who does tax forms, they're going to go right with it. And you may say, because when somebody buys in there, I mean, let's put it this way, if Dan gets a new client, he puts $100 million in the S&P today, guess what happens? He's going to buy the spiders, and the specialist is going to buy all the stocks. I don't call them specialists, I don't much anymore, Dan, or whatever they call them, but whoever the person who manufactures, he probably still is a specialist, the spiders, what he does is he's going to short spiders to Dan, okay? This is how the mechanism works. You know this, Dan, and if I'm wrong, please mm-hmm. tell me. He's going to short spiders to Dan, and he's going to go out and accumulate the 500 stocks in the ratio of which they're supposed to be. And he's going to turn around, and he's going to deposit those shares at State Street Bank, and he's going to say, hey, man, give me some spiders. And they'll issue you the spiders that are covered by the stock that he just deposited. He does the work, not State Street Bank, right? So that's how spiders get created. Now, he doesn't care whether the 412th stock is a dog. He knows that based on the percentage, he has to give that to State Street to get him his spiders. Same way in the way out. If all of a sudden everybody starts puking the spiders out at the guy, he doesn't care if your favorite stock is Microsoft. It's 10% or 5% of the S&P. Every time, you know, I sell $1 billion worth of this stuff, guess what? 10 million of Microsoft, there it goes. Right. Bang. It's yours, buddy. And that's what you're saying. I mean, the mechanism.
Yeah, exactly what I'm saying.
I think a lot of people, though, Dan, and I know I get into this because it's, you know, that's what I did forever. But I think a lot of people don't get the mechanism. And if you get them, it's kind of a shock to them. What do you mean? The guy doesn't just sell the stocks he doesn't like? No. He sells all 500 of them. And he doesn't care. That's not his
right.
job.
It's the same. You know, I managed mutual funds I was a fund manager for mutual funds for a long time. And it would be the same challenge that I would have as the portfolio manager or the fund manager. So we would get withdrawals, and it might just be because we had one large shareholder that was selling. Well, then you have to decide what you're going to sell, and you don't want to necessarily sell one specific position, unless that's, you know, you might be selling based on your conviction in these companies. So you do have, that's what we call active management, where you do have, as a portfolio manager or a mutual fund, you do have a decision that you can make. However, generally you're going to sell across the board, so the winners and the losers are going to end up going out, and it's even more so with ETFs. So in an index fund or an ETF, they don't look at each individual stock or bond or whatever the fund is and say, the manager doesn't say, okay, well, we have less conviction in these names, so we just got a bunch of people wanting to pull out and we have to sell, so we'll sell the names we have less conviction in. They don't do that with an ETF, with a passive fund. They sell across the board. So they're going to sell the winners and the losers. They're going to sell the ones as an active manager. We have more conviction, meaning that you believe that they have a better potential to outperform, and the ones that have less conviction. So that is the challenge with ETFs. Now, the problem too, Chief, is that if we think about the creation, ETFs have been around for a while, but they've grown tremendously since 2009, when we've been on this upward trend that's been almost only in one direction, with a couple of little hiccups for the pandemic and a few other things, but not, it's generally been all the way up. So we haven't seen a period where ETFs were negatively hurt. Certain types of ETFs and passive funds are going to hit bad based on liquidity. So if you have money in a small cap ETF or a small cap, when they have to sell them, there's less liquidity, so they're going to have to sell some of these stocks at a lower price. And if they're getting hit, if every ETF that does small caps, only does small caps, is getting hit, it's going to cause not only an issue with, you know, the price dropping because of that, but another bigger problem is going to be liquidity, trying to get out of them.
Dan,
if you have an ETF of high yield bonds, which was my specialty, they're going to be less liquid. If you have an ETF of mortgage securities, so you have to be very careful in getting in these specialized passive funds. And you know, we go back to the basic lessons we learned in, you know, in finance or investment 101. In order to diversify away your risk, you know, 29 or 30 stocks will diversify 95% of your stock specific risk. So that's why the Dow Jones has 30 stocks. That's where that comes from. 500 is a different story, right? So you have the S&P, you have 500 stocks.
Wait, hold
stocks
on. Could you go back and explain that one again, Dan? I'm sorry, the Dow one.
Yeah, so if you're going to create a portfolio of stocks, the number that you need, the magic number that you need in order to diversify what's called stock-specific risk. So that means that if you had an equal weighting of 29 or 30 stocks, then you've diversified away 95% of the risk of one stock, you know, tanking. So that's the number of stocks you need in order to be in a truly diversified portfolio that's going to protect you from one stock dropping, right? You don't need 500 stocks to do that. You only need 30 to diversify the risk of one of them falling out. So there's a 95%, you diversify away 95% of that risk by owning 30 stocks. So the Dow Jones was created because of that concept.
Yeah, but the Dow Jones only had 12 when they started, right?
Right, but the number 30, the reason they've stuck at that for a long time is just because over time we have history to see where the, we call it stock-specific risk, how that's evolved over time, and 30 is the magic number. So you haven't seen the Dow go up to 35 or 40 or 50, and that's the reason for that number, that number of stocks.
Dan, what would now mutual fund is different because you guys can buy everything on the close. That's when you owe the guys the price, right, on the close. But right. I know there were guys on the, well, when I traded on the floor, there were people that would trade the basket. Now, the basket, I traded the S&P 100, but then there was the 500. But still, even then, you could probably take 20 or 30 stocks and catch 65, 70% of the value. you know.
The upset, yeah.
Now, my question is, what do you think, speculate, and Greg, too, you can answer. What, if you and I are trading the spiders all day long, it's only when we get a big imbalance that we're actually going to State Street Bank and give them all 500. What do you suppose our the size of our active basket is? If somebody comes in and buys a boatload of spiders, I'm going to say, I'm just going to lob one out there and you guys critique me. I'm going to say that their active basket is probably 35 to 40 stocks at most. And that probably gets them 70 to 75%, maybe even 80 of the S&P 500. At the other 470 or 450 are just, they don't, the only time they do those is when they go and they actually have to go to State Street and get more spiders.
I would say that's probably true. That's about right. So I think 30 is, like I said, 30 is the magic number. Because if you look at the percentage that it, how much stock specific risk is diversified away, like your optimum range, and this is my math mind thinking about this, is the number 30. And that's going to be where they stay in that, in the range of 30. You know, could be up to 35 or 40, but it's not going to be 75 or 80 or 100.
But if you toss in Berkshire Hathaway or something to the Dow, doesn't that affect it?
Yes.
Way more.
Well, the Dow is a little. Actually, it's amazing you guys are talking about this, because on Tuesday, we went through this for like 10 minutes where we talked about the difference in the price weighted versus the cap weighted. I mean, the Dow, basically nobody gives a crap about the Dow because it's a price weighted index. So a dollar move in Microsoft is the same as a dollar move in Verizon. You know, well, okay, one's $40 and the other's $500. It's still like what, six? It's a $6 or $7 move in the Dow. So they're all the same. It's screwed up. It's not cap weighted. Where in the OEX, SPX, Spider, QQQ, the RUT, you know, which is the Russell. If a stock is worth, if that goes up 2%, and it's 2% of the index goes up 2% of 2%. Right.
So if you did a cap weighted S&P 30. That would be as diversified as the OEX-ish?
Well, the OEX was 100. It was a cap-weighted 100, so it wouldn't be quite as diversified.
I mean, it would be 95%.
Yeah, well, you know, again...
It depends on...
It's a good question. It is specific to the stocks, as you mentioned earlier, that are components. And I think the concept of the Dow is to stay well-diversified by industry, so that you have a true picture of what's going on. But if you're looking just at market cap, again, you know, we're looking at these
all
companies
tech.
That where the market caps have exploded. So I don't know how relevant that is to really our overall economy. You know, is it relevant to really what's going on in the market? It would from a trading point of view, but it wouldn't from an economic point of view.
Well, if you have a cap weighted index, again, maybe I ran over too quickly and I don't know, we got to go to break here at some point, but. If you go to Capweight Index, Greg, you pick the 100 stocks. You know, we'll have the Greg Index. You drop them on a blackboard showing my age. I'm going to say, okay, well, you're going to take, we'll pick a number here, Caterpillar. It's 325 times 20 million shares. So whatever that math is, then that's Caterpillar's piece. You do it for all 100 stocks, and you get to a bottom line, it's where and it says it's, you know, 48 billion, then you'll say, all right, well, Caterpillar is now 1% of that index. It's totally mathematical. There's no mentality into it. So if Caterpillar were to double, say, and it's worth 1% of the index, is going to go up 1%. But now Caterpillar is now 2% of the index because now it has a higher, it adjusts every day to the cap weight. So the next day, if Caterpillar doubles again, it's going to move the index 2%, and now it's worth 4%. You know what I'm saying? We're in a Dow, that doesn't happen. The Dow, it's all price. It's up $5. That's $30 in the Dow, you know, type of thing.
It's basically rebalanced too. I mean, yeah. So there's not going to, you're not going to get into this thing where you have one stock dominating the index, or a handful of stocks. And so I guess to answer your question, Greg, the answer would probably be not sure, but probably not the case if it's cap weighted.
So, Dan, just because you mentioned since 2008 we've had this uptrend, I just did a back of the envelope here. 2008, the money supply was $8.2 trillion. 2020, before COVID, was 15.4. So let's say it's up 90% divided by 12 years is what? 7.5%, 8% a year when the economy grew probably, what, 2? So you've got a 6% inflation rate really in there that people are lying about. And guess what? The market's probably up 6% a year, which I'm sure it almost exactly is. How does all that match up, Dan?
More than that.
I'm talking about 6% a year from 2008 to 2020. It wasn't more than that.
I don't think. For the past, like, 10 or 15 years, okay, we've been up, like, 10%.
Well, there's been some year. I don't know. I'll dig that. While we're on break, I'll dig that up. S&P futures up 18, NASDAQ futures up 96. I'll bet it's almost equal, but I will look.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
I'm a big fan of money. I like it. I use it. I have a little. I keep it in a jar on top of my refrigerator. I'd like to put more in that jar.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
People of the United States of America, your Congress is bought. Your Congress is incapable of making legislation on health care, banking, trade, or taxes, because if they do it, they will lose their political funding and they won't do it. But I'm the President of the United States, and I won't have a country that is run by a bought Congress. So I'm not going to work with a bought Congress and try to be Mr. Big Guy. I'm working with the bought Congress. I'm going to abandon the bought Congress like Teddy Roosevelt did, and I'm going to go to the people of the United States and I'm going to say, you've got a bought Congress. And until we get rid of the bought Congress, which is Jimmy Williams' constant point, which is get the money out of politics, and until a president says that's the problem and says he's going to fix it, there is no policy that I can possibly see, no matter how brilliant your idea may be, or your idea, or my idea, or her idea, or your idea at home.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Lone Wolf Bank Stocks and Jacks. Greg challenged me here from 2008 to January 1st of 2020. The money supply was up, and I think with an area of not much growth, some growth, was up 90%, and the market was up 120. So the market was up a little more, but you know what I'm talking about. We're pretty close. I wouldn't have expected it to be exact, but it was some. Say S&P futures up 15, NASDAQ futures up 85. We were up a little more when we came in, but we're still doing to the upside here. We have the Dow futures up 17. In the Dow, let me get my chart off my page here so I can tell everyone individual stocks in the Dow. I got Goldman Sachs up a buck. I got not much. The big movers are Nvidia up 482. We've got Meta up 313. Those are the stocks you got to watch. Just the rest of the stuff, you know, not so much. So we have over in Europe, these guys are higher. DAX up 83. It was up more a minute ago. An hour ago, sorry, not a minute ago. 0.5%. FTSE up 19.2%. They were up a lot more. CAC around up 57.8, but still up. On Tuesday, very slow day, Dow was up 56, S&P unchanged. Was the last time you saw that. NASDAQ up 5. So it was a day before holiday sort of day. Over in Asia, today the Nikkei is up 62 to 38,633. Hang Seng down 95.5%, 18,335. Shanghai making a move towards 3,000 here at 3,005, down 13 points. They've been pushing money in to try and get the market up. It's worked for a little while, but now it seems like it's not working now necessarily. 10-year up 4 basis points to 4.26. The Bund up 2 basis points, 2.42. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.96. We've got oil up 6 cents, 81.63. Again, 40 cents higher than last week I paid. Not happy about that. Brent up 28 cents, 85.35. Natural gas down 7 cents, 2.83. Arbob up a penny, 2.49. We've got gold 2-week high, up 8.20, 23.55. Silver up 89 cents, 3%, 30.45. Maybe we'll let Greg, our technical analyst, tell me, is this going to get slapped down again like it always does, or is this a buy? I don't know. Wish I did know this stuff. Copper up 6 cents, 4.56. We've got U.S. dollar, 107.2 against the euro, so kind of unchanged. Same thing with the pound, 126.8. And we've got Bitcoin finally bouncing back a little bit here, up 1,100 bucks. It was up more than that a while ago, 65,970. A lot of stuff there, Greg. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
The temperature actually dropped 2 degrees since we last did this, so it is 7:38 here.
Turn the AC off, open the windows, is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. 70 degrees now. Still a high of 78 with possible thunderstorms after 3 p.m. here in Chicago. Phoenix, 84 degrees now. Sunny and hot with a high of 114. Excessive heat warning there. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 33 minutes. Edens from Lake Cooks, 55 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 40 minutes. Inbound Ryan from 95th is 21 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 of the Ryan is 30 minutes. Sports, Cubs beat the Giants at home. That was 5-6. Diamondbacks lose at Nationals, 1-3. And the Astros beat the White Sox on the south side. That was 4-1. That's all I got, Chief.
So, Dan, what'd you think of my little back-of-the-envelope money supply? Went up 7.4% a year for 12 years when our growth was, what, 2? So we probably had an inflation every year of 5, and we were told it was 0.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. That was only going until 2020, right?
So yeah, well, then the COVID stuff blew up after that. I didn't even clue
totally
that.
Blew up after that. Yeah, those numbers would be a lot more extreme right now. That's the period where things were wacky, and where it's going to take a while for us to get back to a normalized level. No question about it.
Dan, I'm trying to be nice here.
If you discount the what's it called? If you go to the beginning of 2010 to the end of 2023, the returns approximately average out to 10.6 a year.
Well, yeah, but now you've boosted the money supply unbelievably.
Yeah. So in 2024, it's what was last year? I don't know. I need to do the additional, but it's up there, and then so call it what 4 or 5% over quoted inflation.
Well,
yeah,
over not per year, but yeah, it's well, yeah, quoted, yeah. Well, I'm talking about the money supplies to give you a better number. What the question is, I guess, and this is what you know in the Midwest. Dan's in Boston; he's from Florida normally. In the Midwest, you're never going to think that when you bought a stock at 100 and it's now 200, that you're not a genius. You're never going to think that really it's 200 because the value of the $200 is dropped down to where it's the same as it was when it was 100. I mean, nobody's ever going to think that way, right? Dan?
You're right, and I think it does. It's definitely regional. So we talk about stocks, but let's look at real estate for a minute, which is also talking about inflation. Boston Globe yesterday, front page, a whole story on housing market here and how out of control it is, and the median price home here, median, is $955,000.
And, okay.
And I think L.A., so I looked at some of the other cities. L.A., I think it was $1.1 million, median home price.
All right, so what percentage of the population can afford that? I'm going to say...
Yeah, absolutely. It's
5%? The
affordability issue. There are some trends going on that I have kind of... that have come to light more from the meetings I've had up here. And some of the trends that aren't there because everybody's in this myopic view. They're in this very narrow-minded view about, you know, I made money on NVIDIA, I'm going to buy more. So here's what's really going on. Biotech industry is already matured. It were already coming down the other side. There are layoffs, there are salary cuts, there, you know, this is the biotech capital of the country. So that is changing. So you talk to the younger people especially, not the same place it was. The people who have funneled the money into the system here are the people that cashed out of those biotech companies with 50 million, like huge amounts of money. And that is going to continue to fuel this, as you call it, money growth. Those are things that we're definitely seeing. Same thing with the tech in the West Coast, let's say, especially in the Silicon Valley area. That's already peaked. There are layoffs. You have to look at the granular stuff, what's going on day to day. And yes, there's a lot of potential. There always has been a lot of potential. But we're in, you know, we've passed the peak of these industries already. So the thought that these industries are going to just continue to explode, not happening. Absolutely not happening. And inflation is still there, which I think, you're right, some people just say, okay, I'll pay that extra money. And even here, I've gotten some sticker shock and some of the things that I have to pay. People are looking at you with a straight face. And I'm like, oh, geez, sticker shock. So you're right, they will get, people will accept those new price levels because they don't have a choice. But what has also happened, other salaries have continued to keep up with inflation. That is what we did not have pre-pandemic. What we were looking for inflation to be a major issue was wage inflation. We didn't have that. We have that today. So my belief is it's going to take longer for inflation to come down. It's going to take longer for rates to come down. That's what the Fed just said yesterday. That's what I believe, that this isn't going to be a quick turnaround in terms of inflation coming down. It's going to be a slower period, and that's not necessarily bad, but inflation is going to remain high. There's no question. But looking at what's really happening with the economy, GDP growth in the first quarter was 1.6%. That's slower. The annual, you know, this year, or since 2022, where it peaked, you know, the average is about, the average now they're talking about 2.5% in GDP. It's slowing, and that is, it's gradually happening. But as you've mentioned many times, the money supply and this incredible, you know, these wealthy tech and biotech people cashing out and throwing even more money into the system is going to keep this pace of slowdown slow. It's not going to be this rapid slowdown because there is so much money in the system. And you're absolutely right, Chief. You don't see that everywhere in the country. You see it probably more specifically in the Northeast and the West Coast, that we still have this crazy run-up in prices, this crazy, reaching that new price point. I mean, I agree with Powell. I think price stability is where we need to be. I agree with the fact that they're holding off cutting rates. I think that's wise. As a bond manager, I'll say that's definitely wise to keep, you know, to keep this process happening slowly. I think as an investor, you have to be careful because having some exposure to these stocks is good, but I would still say keep trimming, keep a large portion of your money in protected securities. If it's a taxable account, U.S. Treasury bills, treasury notes, shorter term treasuries, and municipal bonds. And then, you know, have a little bit of it, but a smaller percentage of it in the equity market. We do have some signs that things are slowing. And where it has slowed more, and it's interesting to see the rate cuts overseas. Switzerland cut their rate. We saw this morning we're seeing the Bank of England. So
they held them steady. They didn't cut. They held them steady.
They didn't cut, but we're seeing them talk about cutting rates. We're seeing them going in that direction because while they are seeing inflation, they don't have the same craze that we do in our the Nasdaq market. There's at least, I think they're closer to doing that than we are. I think they'll do it before us, just as Canada did. So those other countries who aren't experiencing as much of the tech craze as we are, or as much of this momentum movement, will probably be ahead of us in cutting rates.
Dan, I made a comment on on Tuesday. I mean, I forget who was on. He asked me what the difference is between... this is going to lead me into a second very serious question for you, because you're my man on this. What is the difference between, you know, 1999, 2000, and now? And I think there's one thing I think is hugely different, that when the Fed put all the money in for Y2K, thinking that the world was going to come to an end, nothing was going to work, and people needed all the cash, and blah, blah, blah. And there was, you know, there was reasons for them to think that. I'm not saying they're idiots. They weren't. But the minute it was over and it didn't happen, they started to draw some of that money out. I mean, not dramatically, but they drew some of it out. So the bubble that they created for like the 6 months into 2000 and so forth, they essentially deflated. Now, I'm not talking about the whole dot-bomb thing, but the last 10-15% of it, I think, was almost totally Fed-made because of Y2K, and they withdrew that out. So they essentially, I won't say caused, that started to sell off a little bit, okay?
Right.
But now this time, despite what Powell, and again, if I had a beer with the guy, I'd probably like him. Despite what he says, he is so full of crap when it comes to, he's worried about inflation, and they're worried about maintaining this wealth bubble. They have no more, they would never conceive of draining some money out, worried about every man affording a car and having the market drop 10%. They do not want that on their watch. So, but the question is, how long can you keep it going? I mean, how long can you constantly... I mean, I have an article in here by somebody, and he said, if the recession comes, guys like you and me, Dan, our instinct is going to say, wow, you want to at least be protected. You don't want to be in the market during a recession. He's saying, don't even worry about it. We just had a depression, and it went up. They're going to pour money into the system. And that you will never, in their mind, is to the extent that they can pull it off, we will never come down. Same thing with every other central bank in the world is of the same focus. They no more care about inflation and full employment than the man in the moon, according to this guy. It's all about this wealth bubble they created. They can't, they're not about to poke the balloon like they did in 2000. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, but I also think another fear, and maybe even a bigger fear, is their fear of being wrong. So the money supply is truly the issue here in terms of inflation, and withdrawing money is really what needs to happen concurrent with lower, you know, with keeping rates where they are. So that's what's going to keep the slowing happening. But there is, you know, there's certainly some political issues that are getting involved here. And certainly none of us want to see people at the lower end of the spectrum having to struggle, but where it's going to change, I believe, is where the households decide, okay, I'm no longer paying this. I'm no longer, you know, that price is too high. We're just going to cut back. That's going to end up hurting businesses. And at some point that's going to trickle down to, you know, but you're right from the point of view of the Fed and the amount of power they have and why, you know, everybody is sitting there, you know, on the edge of their seats every time they say, you know, Powell says something or has a conference. My thing is that I agree with everything you're saying, and I'll add something, just that they're so afraid of being wrong.
Dan, I'm going to say that they boxed themselves and they painted themselves into a corner so tight that right now they are powerless.
Yes. Yeah, and I think for a number of different reasons that's the case. I mean, I think there's certainly political pressure. There's not going to be as much flexibility, but they are definitely reactive rather than proactive.
Well, but they painted themselves into their own corner.
They have.
They gave in to Congress and the president on the COVID situation. They printed a bunch of money and they sent it to people. Name me one person that anybody knows of that would make the trade for what did you get, $3,500 4 years ago?
Yeah.
With what they're paying now in inflation, everybody would be happy to give you your $3,500 back.
Absolutely agree with you. There's no question about it. This is the issue that the thing is, every single person sees it, no matter what your income level is or where you stand. There is talk, like even something as simple as like raising the, you know, the tolls getting from New Jersey into New York City and how that impacts people at a certain economic level more than others. Absolutely true, but the people at the higher level still don't want to be, you know, still don't want to be paying these extra rates. And there's a point that I think people get to where it's going to be, there's going to be more, there's going to be, they're going to, households are not going to allow this to happen. They're just going to pull back. They're going to find alternative ways of dealing with these price increases. And, you know, I think the vast number of people would also agree with that, that this, at some point there has to be, you know, this inflation has to stop. It has to come down.
Well,
it has to normalize.
When you pump 40% into the market in 2.5 years, anybody of logic would say, now that things are better, we better drag at least 10% of that out, and they're not.
I absolutely agree with you. I've been saying that. Take some off the top. If you've got money in the equity market, I tell everybody that I know, it doesn't matter your age, what your age group is.
I'm saying
you're talking about money taking the Fed taking money out of the system.
I'm not so sure the market's going to go down, Dan.
Here's kind of an analogy. Again, it's not playing the devil's advocate, but just talking about the sectors that are you know, running away right now with this momentum. Let's think about what happened to crypto and the crypto craze. And what do you have with crypto? And I still don't totally understand. I don't understand it. I understand the concept of a global digital currency, but there, again, something that hasn't really been proven, something that's, that's something that's had a huge amount of volatility, something that isn't really tangible. So that was a craze. And if you actually invested,
what do you mean, was a craze? It's at its all time high, damn near.
Now it is, but I'm saying that you've seen a huge amount of volatility. Yeah. If you're willing to stomach that, that's fine. But there's other areas that became crazes. EVs. You know, there was that huge craze with EVs. And, you know, when I came to Boston, I was at, you know, getting a rental car, and I had to persuade the woman to give me a car that wasn't an EV. And nobody wanted the EVs to rent. So it's a craze that just happens, that's not logical, irrational. And cannabis was another one too. It doesn't, you got to be careful how you translate that into the financial markets, the stock market. You got to be very careful how you take this excitement about a concept and then translate that into the stock market. Because the stock market is, we're supposed to be valuing something. Our job as analysts and managers is to value something where it's appropriate, fair market value today. And instead, we're basing fair market value not on where it's going to be a year from now, but where it's going to be 5 or 10 years from now, with a lot of optimism.
Well, Dan, I mean, it's somewhat historical. I mean, if you
somewhat,
want.
But it's still, to me, it seems like in the past it was based more on things that were tangible.
Well,
you know, whether it was,
I hate to hate
autos, or, you know, there was certain, you could see. And this is sort of based on something that's not necessarily as tangible.
Well, I think that you could, by the way, you know, I'm agreeing with you, but I'm always trying to play devil's advocate. If you go back on things that have been, they're unvaluable, unable to be valued in an early stage, which AI is. I mean, you're going to say, God, nobody's made a dime on it yet, which is probably true. But now you look at it and you go, oh man, you have no idea how much this is going to change the world. Okay, well, the dot-bomb stuff. Hey, buddy, I'm getting 50,000 clicks today. Every one of those things is going to be a sale 2 years from now. How dare you tell me the thing's not worth $40 bazillion? Well, okay, and as soon as the first one hit and the first one knew how much it was worth, the thing went down. But same thing happened in railroads. Same thing happened in TV. And NBC, I think, traded before there was a TV higher than it did for... It took like 10 years after there was a TV to catch up, right?
Exactly.
And didn't
Absolutely.
The same thing happen to TVs? It was something. Well, it happens to drugs all the time. I mean, the concept's always worth more than the reality, right?
No, that's true. I just think, though, when the concept is tangible, you know, you can touch it and feel it and see it. You know, like, say, real estate, for example. It's a little easy to have a level of comfort when you invest. I think it's a little tougher when it's something that is totally, you know, ethereal. It's something that you just can't, you know, you can't even imagine. And ask anybody what AI is. A lot of people continue to ask that question. And while I have a general understanding, I don't totally understand what predicting certain uses, you know, where it could be very beneficial, but then also knowing that there's going to be a lot of hurdles along the way. There's going to be a lot of volatility. So it just depends on what your stomach is willing to handle. And I just say small percentage. And if it's something that's run up, we're talking about stocks here, if something has run up, take some off the top. Take 5% or 10% off the top. The next rally, sell into the rally. Because what's also happening, I'm saying that there's some signs of these industries already starting to turn over. You see it particularly with younger people. And
I'm with you.
Boston's the younger people tech capital of the country, I mean, in terms of biotech. And what's happening, not only are they not able to afford, the younger people able to afford housing, basic housing at huge salaries, they're also faced with a very different dynamic than they were, you know, 5 years ago or 3 years ago during the pandemic. They're all being asked to come back to the office. They're given fewer benefits. And a lot of them, even going younger, like Gen Z, do not have the skill set to replace the retiring managers.
Oh, without a doubt.
To replace the retiring
managers. Dan, we got a dash here, but too quick. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just trying to find a way. Is it possible that it's different this time? I think the Fed's somewhat in that game. But I have one other real quick, because we got a dash. Our producer says we're Q's versus Russell. Can they go the opposite ways forever, or is that just the sign of the times? Nobody cares about these small companies anymore. Is that going to continue, or at some point here, if I put money to work, should I put it in Russell? I did last week. Should I be forgetting about that index, or should I still be doing it?
I think you should still be doing it. But again, the problem with small cap, and we've done some small cap conferences recently, is liquidity. So if there's any concerns, small cap will definitely get hit. But it is trading behind NASDAQ. So I would say, again, have a small portion there. Try to be well diversified across stocks. You know, try to be well diversified across industries. Don't be very careful about getting too specific. Russell definitely has legs, I think, in here. If everything else is going to go up, those names can go up as well. So
all right, Dan, enjoy yourself in Boston. You guys got heat there too, but I don't think you can get away from it right now. Enjoy yourself.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. What day?
Thursday.
Well, Thursday is the day. We're looking forward to it. But SP futures up 11, NASDAQ futures up 69. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Because you ever notice every movie about Boston is about some guy trying to get out of Boston? It's like, well, if I see you here in the morning, I will fucking kill you myself. You go fucking make something of yourself, kid. You're not going to just hang around here wearing construction boots and a cowhide. Ben Affleck sitting by a riverbank finally found serenity with a hipster beard. This is how you can tell Boston's a shitty city.
That's all, folks.